Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, February 24th. Perry says state's plan to address water concerns is insufficient. The story was written by Mella McEwen. Water concerns have flowed through State Senator Charles Perry's legislative career. In his luncheon keynote address at the first day of the Permian Basin Water and Energy Conference, the Republican from Lubbock detailed his recent water-focused efforts in the Texas legislature. In last year's session, he reported, he worked to defeat some initiatives that he said were disguised as private property rights while also seeking to address the state's water supply. The state has a water plan, he noted, but still falls about 6.8 million acre-feet short of what is needed. Quote, the plan does not meet our needs, he stated. That's why it remains part of the conversation. It's imperative we find a way to provide a water source in perpetuity, end quote. That is one reason he worked to create the Texas Produced Water Consortium, which was finally enacted last year and is being overseen by Texas Tech University. A first report from the consortium is due in September, and Perry said he is looking for three significant pieces of information. Is there enough produced water to do what he hopes, which is to fill that gap between what the water plan calls for and what the state will actually need? Is it possible, technologically, to clean that produced water and distribute it back into the water supply network? To accomplish the first two, what are the costs? To those expressing concern about produced water possibly contaminating fresh water supplies, he responded, quote, we won't contaminate freshwater supplies by introducing bad water, end quote. There were several factors that combined to make the conversation about beneficial use of produced water relevant, he said. Rising concerns about increasing seismicity linked to water injection, especially around populated areas like Midland and Odessa, and last year's winter storm Uri. During last year's deep freeze, he said, 16 million Texas households were under boil water notices, something he called unacceptable. Quote, if we're going to be serious about fixing the stuff brought to light by Uri before the next Uri, we need to do it properly, he said. He warned that the federal government could take control of the state's water management through regulations, such as how waters of the U.S. are defined. The Environmental Protection Agency's promise to revise that definition threatens to discredit all the work the state has done in regard to water management, he said. Quote, there are no better stewards of water than agriculture and the oil and gas industry, he said. Texas does a fantastic job regulating its water, end quote. Fresh water, he said, quote, is the most urgent and least attended to conversation we're not having, and in fact needs to be a national conversation. Firm keeps output steady. Diamondback says area production to remain flat. The story was written by Paul Takahashi of Bloomberg. Diamondback Energy Incorporated Chairman and CEO Travis Stice said the shale driller will maintain flat production in the Permian Basin this year. The Texas Wildcatters that launched the U.S. shale boom are resisting the temptation to pump more oil, even as oil prices approach $100 a barrel, heeding investor demand for fiscal discipline after years of poor capital returns. Stice said he expects Diamondback's maintenance capital plan to generate nearly $4 billion of free cash flow in 2022, of which at least 50% would be returned to shareholders through increased dividends, share buybacks, and possibly a variable dividend, according to an earnings release. New director says coalition dedicated to road safety. The story was written by Mella McEwen. Leadership has changed, but the Permian Road Safety Coalition mission of improving road safety continues. Ellen Ramsey is now executive director of the nonprofit, succeeding Scott Scheffler, who has returned to Shell's Houston office. The coalition's membership is comprised of oil and gas upstream, midstream, and downstream companies, oil field service companies, county and city first responders, and state agencies, among others. This year's director-level sponsors and board members are from Atlas Sand, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Occidental, and Texas Mutual, with the Texas Department of Transportation and Texas Oil and Gas Association serving as advisory members. Ramsey, who said the position combines her career of civic volunteerism and oil and gas background, said the coalition will continue its program of educating drivers about road safety. Quote, "We are going to have road safety luncheons," she said, with the first being March 23rd in Pecos at the Reeves County Civic Center. Sponsored by West Texas National Bank, it will feature Jose Sanchez, director of the Texas Department of Safety West Texas Region, Chief Adrian Garcia of the Reeves County Emergency Services District, and Gene Powell, Public Information Officer with the Texas Department of Transportation's Odessa District. DPS will also be conducting mock commercial vehicle inspections to help operators understand what DPS looks for in the inspections. Ramsey said it's been found that most of the unsafe vehicles on Permian Basin roads are from smaller trucking companies without the resources to adequately train drivers or inspect their vehicles. Quote, "We want to give them the resources," she said. She called the coalition young, noting that it was formed in 2019. In those 3 years, she said, it has been credited by the Permian Basin Metropolitan Planning Organization with helping bring about a 23% reduction in traffic fatalities and 30% reduction in vehicle crashes between 2019 and 2021, along with the Permian Strategic Partnership, Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance, and Midland and Odessa Development Corps. Another significant accomplishment, according to Ramsey, was partnering with the PSP to distribute $1.1 million of equipment to 51 first responder agencies throughout the Permian Basin. Such partnerships are a key initiative for Ramsey, along with educational opportunities and programs such as the Road Safety Luncheons. She said member engagement and enhanced communications will also be important, as will growing the coalition's profile in the region, quote, "letting people know about us," end quote. The coalition already has programs in area high schools to promote safe driving practices, and all members are offered free access to the Safe to Save app, which provides discounts and free merchandise from participating businesses for those who practice safe driving. She said plans are, later in the year, to go to area truck stops, offer drivers breakfast burritos and coffee, and emphasize basic safety driving practices like don't drive distracted, wear seatbelts, and don't speed. The goal is to go where the truckers are and engage with them, she explained. The coalition is also participating in industry meetings to promote its message. In November, in conjunction with this annual meeting, the coalition will present Road Safety Champion Awards, sponsored by BPX Energy. Quote, "We want to recognize our members' accomplishments. We want our members to be engaged and to recognize the companies that have worked hard to make changes," she said. Road safety is an important topic that has a broad impact, she said. Safe driving means using common sense, she said. Quote, "It all boils down to driver behavior. And for the industry, It involves ensuring equipment is properly maintained, Ramsey said. Business Buzz. Initiative awards $500,000 to startups. The story was written by J.C. Lewis. Five Midland startups received checks for $100,000 for winning the Midland Entrepreneurial Challenge. The challenge hosted an awards ceremony and check presentation Tuesday evening at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center Ray Greathouse Recital Hall. Midland AF, The Birth Center, Magrum Consulting Incorporated, Low Street Books, and Thai Pickle Pickles were winners of the challenge this year. University of Texas Permian Basin Assistant Professor of Management Brian Peckham said 124 businesses signed up for the orientation and challenge this year. The year the challenge was created, there were seven participants. Quote, we had 124 businesses sign up for the orientation, with 45 that officially registered for the challenge, Peckham said. Continuing the quote, it is a six-month commitment where business owners are coming to classes and talking about different business principles like accounting, legal, marketing, and other aspects, end quote. The business owners then submitted a fact sheet about what their business is about. Out of the 45, 18 businesses were selected to move on. Then 10 were eliminated, leaving 8 business owners to make presentations to the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center Ray Greathouse Recital Hall for the chance to win $100,000 for their business. Out of the 8, 5 local startups were selected to win $100,000 each. 4 judges decided which businesses advanced throughout the challenge. Peckham said over the past 5 years, the businesses that have won the challenge have grossed more than $7 million in taxable revenue, and they've created or retained more than 60 full-time positions and more than 20 part-time positions. Quote, one of the things I'm most proud of is that some of the winners tonight are business owners who have participated previously but didn't win, Peckham said. They went back and they worked on their business plans, and came back to try again, end quote. Midland AF's Stacy Livingston said her business was born after moving to Midland 3 years ago. She determined there was a want for a community while centralizing resources online. Quote, I had a hard time figuring out what was happening here, she said. It started as an opportunity to seek out the cool stuff that Midland had to offer that wasn't online. I met a lot of amazing business owners and made a lot of friendships and connections, end quote. She added that she entered MEC 2 years ago before really knowing what the business was, but she said she is happy she came back to do the challenge again. Courtney Luoma is a certified nurse midwife and driving force behind the birth center. She was accompanied by Laura Smith, who will be the birth center manager. Quote, we are going to open a state-of-the-art birthing facility on Michigan Avenue across from Midland Memorial Hospital, Luoma said. Continuing the quote, there's been a need in our community for a birth center for a long time, since the old one closed about 5 years ago. Birth centers are a standard amenity across cities in Texas, end quote. She added that currently women in Midland can either give birth at home or at the hospital. Some decide to drive to Lubbock to give birth at a birth center. Quote, we actually are losing business in our community for women who are traveling to have the birth experience they want, she said. Magrum Consulting Incorporated was founded by Principal Claudius Sanchez-Szaszowski and Project Manager Eric Hart with a desire to serve the engineering industry. The business is a consulting and civil engineering design firm that offers services to the produced water industry in Midland and southeast New Mexico. Quote, We've been around for about 3 years, Hart said. We are looking to expand our market into helping with municipalities here in the area. Low Street Books, a bookstore, wine bar, and restaurant, opened in May of 2021 at the Micro Market. Owners Hannah and Seth Struhn and Lauren and Brian Johnston were winners of the MEC Award. Quote, "We're bringing a little bit more life to downtown and just expanding the community down there," Lauren Johnston said. Ty Pickle Pickle's business partners, Tyler Brawley and Christopher Morales, submitted their wholesale pickle business to the challenge this year. Quote, "We've had the company for about 2 years," Brawley said. "What we do is we make pickles. We are going to be providing for businesses, for restaurants, for retail at wholesale. We hope to get into our own retail at some point as well," end quote. MEC was launched in 2017 with the support and collaboration of Midland Development Corporation, University of Texas Permian Basin Small Business Development Center, local government, and businesses. The Entrepreneurial Challenge is a business competition, but also an opportunity for collaborators and leaders trying to find the best ways to support emerging businesses. The MEC wants to further diversify the economy, which is heavily reliant upon the oil and gas industry, by supporting homegrown businesses. The Buzz. Sharky's Cuts for Kids will expand into Midland. Sharky's Cuts for Kids is going in at Texas Pride Plaza at 4425 West Wadley Avenue, Suite 120. A Sharky's Cuts for Kids opened in Odessa in 2019 by Midlander Lacey Alterhofen. She told the Reporter Telegram back in 2019 that she had plans to expand the franchise into Midland in the near future. Low Street Market by Micro Market has announced two upcoming markets. The markets will be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. March 5th and April 2nd. The markets are currently taking vendor applications.
Midland man gets 25 years for sexual assault of a child. A 63-year-old Midland man was sentenced to 25 years in prison for aggravated sexual assault of a child. According to a press release from the Midland County District Attorney's Office, the DA's office said that 142nd District Court Judge David Rogers sentenced Ronaldo Ponce Frausto after Frausto made a last-minute decision to change his plea to guilty. Frausto had faced the possibility of punishment from probation up to life imprisonment. The evidence presented in the case showed that on a single occasion, the defendant assaulted the victim, younger than 10 years old, at Frausto's home in May 2018. The victim quickly told her parents about the abuse, leading to a confrontation that saw Frausto admit that the victim was telling the truth. He also made a similar confession to a Midland Police Department detective soon after. The press release stated the judge considered evidence about the impact of the abuse on the victim and her family, as well as the defendant's many medical issues, before determining the sentence. Under the law, the defendant will have to serve at least one half of the 25-year sentence before he is eligible to be considered for parole. Eligibility for parole is not a guarantee that parole will be granted. The case was prosecuted by Midland County First Assistant District Attorney Tim Flathers and Assistant District Attorney Lisa Borden, with assistance from Assistant District Attorney Whitney Garnett. Hello, this is Cindy, continuing to read from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday. Midland man pleads guilty to hate crimes. A 21-year-old Midlander pleaded guilty to hate crimes for attacking an Asian family he believed was responsible for the COVID-19 pandemic because he believed them to be Chinese, according to the Justice Department. Jose Gomez III pleaded guilty to 3 counts of committing a hate crime. He is facing a maximum sentence of life in prison and a $250,000 fine for each offense. On March 14, 2020, Gomez entered Sam's Club and followed the family and their 2 young children because he perceived them to be a threat, as they were from the country who started spreading that disease around. Gomez briefly left the family to grab a serrated steak knife from the store and bent the blade so that when he held the handle in his fist, the blade rested against his knuckles, sharp edge facing outward. Gomez then returned to the family and punched the father in the face, cutting him. Gomez then left the scene, only to retrieve an 8-inch knife from the store. When Gomez returned, he abruptly went after the 2- and 6-year-old children, who were seated in the front basket of the shopping cart. Gomez slashed open the 6-year-old's face. The blade entered millimeters from the child's right eye, split his right ear, and wrapped around to the back of his skull. Gomez also stabbed a Sam's Club employee who intervened to stop Gomez from further assaulting the family. While being held down on the ground, Gomez yelled at the family, "Get out of America." Gomez admitted after his attack that he believed the family was Chinese, and he blamed them for the COVID-19 pandemic. Gomez also admitted he had attempted to kill the 6-year-old child and attacked the store employee because he prevented him from killing the child. An Asian family was shopping when the defendant brutally attacked them because of their race and because he blamed them for the COVID-19 pandemic, said Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Racially motivated hate crimes targeting the Asian American community are on the rise and have no place in our society today. All people deserve to feel safe and secure living in their communities, regardless of race, color, or national origin. The defendant violently and horrifically attacked an unsuspecting innocent family because of how they looked and where he thought they came from, said U.S. Attorney Ashley C. Hoff of the Western District of Texas. This type of hate-based violence has no place in our society and will not be tolerated. These victims and others who suffer such brutal hate-based attacks deserve justice and to live without fear in our communities. We will continue to vigorously enforce federal laws that protect civil rights and combat bias-motivated violence. No one should be afraid to go shopping or feel like they could be targeted by an act of violence based on their race, ethnicity, religion, disability, sexual orientation, gender or gender identity, country of national origin or immigration status, said Special Agent in Charge Jeffrey Downey of the FBI El Paso Field Office. Acts of hate and racism have no place in our community and will not be tolerated. The FBI encourages people who have been victims or witnessed a hate crime to contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. The case was investigated by the Midland Police Department and the FBI. The case is being prosecuted by Assistant U.S. Attorney Glenn Harwood of the Western District of Texas and Trial Attorney Angie Che of the Civil Rights Division's Criminal Section. Officer with local roots honored. Justin Painter, the son of former Midland County Sheriff Gary Painter, was named the Officer of the Year during a ceremony this week. The East Montgomery County Improvement District held a law enforcement dinner in Kingwood. That is where Justin Painter, a deputy for Montgomery County, was honored with a 2021 Officer of the Year award. Painter stands with his daughter Emily at the Kingwood event. Study indicates sharp rise in child poverty after tax credit expiration, by Ashraf Khalil, Associated Press, Washington. The number of children in America living in poverty jumped dramatically after just 1 month without the expanded child tax credit payments, according to a new study. Advocates fear the lapse in payments could unravel what they say were landmark achievements in poverty reduction. Columbia University's Center on Poverty and Social Policy estimates 3.7 million more children were living in poverty by January, a 41% increase from December when families received their last check. The federal aid started last July but ended after President Joe Biden's Build Back Better bill stalled in the sharply divided Congress. Payments of up to $300 per child were delivered directly to bank accounts on the 15th of each month, and last week marked the second missed deposit of the year. The Columbia study, which combines annual U.S. Census data with information from the Census Bureau's monthly current population survey bulletins, found that the monthly child poverty rate increased from 12.1% in December to 17% in January. That's the highest level since December 2020, when the U.S. was grappling with high unemployment and a resurgence of COVID-19. Black and Latino children experienced the highest percentage point increases in poverty, 5.9% and 7.1%, respectively. Megan Curran, policy director for the Center on Poverty and Social Policy, said the sudden spike shows how quickly the payments became core to household financial stability for millions of families after only 6 months. "It really had a huge impact right off the bat," Curran said. "We saw food insecurity drop almost immediately as soon as the payments started. All of that progress that we made could now be lost." Curran said the increase in children living in poverty could also partially reflect rising prices. The new numbers represent a serious setback from the original goals of the Child Tax Credit Program, which ambitiously sought to cut nationwide child poverty in half. As part of Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 rescue package last year, the existing Child Tax Credit Program was massively reshaped, boosting the amount of the payments, greatly expanding the pool of eligible families, and delivering the money in monthly installments, designed to be incorporated into day-to-day household budgets. The program extended payments of $250 per month for children ages 6 through 17 and $300 per month for those under 6 to most families in the country at an annual cost of about $120 billion. The goal was to put discretionary cash in the hands of parents along with the freedom to spend it as they saw fit month to month. Republican lawmakers are generally unified in opposition to the expanded tax credit, describing it as excessive, inflationary, and a disincentive to work. But when it was originally passed, many Democrats openly declared their intention to make the payments a permanent anchor of the American social safety net. The goal for the Democratic-held Congress was to keep the program running and fight about its future months from now, armed with data and millions of anecdotes about the tax credit's benefits. Instead, the 50-member Democratic bloc in the Senate collapsed from within. The West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin held out on his vote for weeks before finally refusing to endorse Biden's social spending package. Manchin cited his opposition to the child tax credit's massive price tag among his reservations with the bill. Earlier this month, Manchin called negotiations on Biden's Build Back Better bill dead. Democratic New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich, one of the expanded child tax credit's strongest advocates, said Wednesday in a statement to the Associated Press that nearly all the children in his state benefited from the credit and that letting it expire was a moral failure. An informal survey conducted of families by the nonprofit advocacy group Parents Together Action found a similarly immediate impact to the lapsed child tax credit payments for respondents, with roughly one in five families surveyed reporting they could no longer afford housing or enough food for their kids. Allison Johnson, the organization's campaign director, said the child tax credit payments were designed so parents would not have to make these really hard choices, she said. The end to the deposits makes it nearly impossible for needy families who may be struggling to pay down debt or cope with major expenses to develop financial stability or momentum, Johnson said. This lack of clarity is super difficult for people. It makes them unable to plan for things, she said. Is Omicron leading to herd immunity? By Victoria Milko, AP science writer. Is Omicron leading us closer to herd immunity against COVID-19? Experts say it's not likely that the highly transmissible variant or any other variant will lead to herd immunity. Herd immunity is an elusive concept and doesn't apply to coronavirus, says Dr. Don Milton at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Herd immunity is when enough of a population is immune to a virus that it's hard for the germ to spread to those who aren't protected by vaccination or a prior infection. For example, herd immunity against measles requires about 95% of a community to be immune. Early hopes of herd immunity against the coronavirus faded for several reasons. One is that antibodies developed from available vaccines or previous infection dwindle with time. While vaccines offer strong protection against severe illness, waning antibodies mean it's still possible to get infected, even for those who are boosted. Then there's the huge variation in vaccinations. In some low-income countries, less than 5% of the population is vaccinated. Rich countries are struggling with vaccine hesitancy, and young children still aren't eligible in many places. As long as the virus spreads, it mutates, helping the virus survive and giving rise to new variants. Those mutants, such as Omicron, can become better at evading the protection people have from vaccines or an earlier infection. Populations are moving toward herd resistance, where infections will continue, but people have enough protection that future spikes won't be as disruptive to society, Milton says. Many scientists believe COVID-19 will eventually become like the flu and cause seasonal outbreaks, but not huge surges.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, February 24th, 2022. Community Calendar. Midland, Our City, Our Stories initiative launching soon. Midland, OCOS, Midland, Our City, Our Stories, is a project that came out of the Midland Diversity Council. The vision is to tell the story of life in Midland through the lens of our diverse community. By sharing Midland's cultural history, the hope is that it will begin a dialogue about our past and current cultural context and our aspirations as a community. Currently, the organization is accepting nominations of people who have a story that needs to be heard. Those selected by the council will be a part of a multimedia project to air over 4 PBS episodes, multiple radio profiles on Marfa Public Radio, and in-person gatherings for more in-depth conversations. To nominate yourself or another individual, fill out the form available at midlandocos.com/nominate or email a request for the form at info@midlandocos.com. The series will begin airing in September of 2022. As research progresses, more information will be available on the Midland Our City Our Stories website. This project is the vision of the Abel Hanger Foundation's Midland Diversity Council. Collaborators include Midland Storytelling Festival, Basin PBS, and Marfa Public Radio. Additional support provided by the Midland Hispanic Cultural Center, Midland African American Roots Historical Cultural Arts Council, Incorporated, Midland Historical Society, and Elite Sports. Early voting centers, days, and times. Elections Office, County Annex, 2110 North A Street, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Thursday and Friday. Centennial Library, Meeting Room 113, 2503 West Loop 250 North. Cogdell Learning Center, Classroom Number 4, 201 West Florida. Fairmont Park Church of Christ, Classroom Number 2, 3813 North Midland Drive. St. Paul United Methodist Church, Fellowship Hall, 4501 Thomason Drive, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Thursday and Friday. Vote totals through Tuesday. Tuesday, 1,225. In person, 4,921. Republican, 4,480. Democrat, 441. By mail, 325. Total, 5,246. Event schedule. Back to Business Mixer, 5:30 p.m. Thursday at Museum of the Southwest. Salute 2022, Out of the Darkness into the Light, 6:30 p.m. Thursday at the Petroleum Club of Midland. Water Circus, 7:30 p.m. Thursday at Midland Park Mall. Brian Milson, 8 p.m. Thursday at the Mule Barn Cantina. Book Club Poetry Night, 6:30 p.m. Friday at Hand Cafe. Cinderella, 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday at Midland Community Theater. Ron White, 10 p.m. Friday at the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center. Wacky Wig Run, 9 a.m. Saturday at the Scarborough Sports Complex. Bowling for Fur Babes Benefiting Grand Companions, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the Diamond Lanes in Odessa. Community Mural Day, 2 p.m. Saturday at Black Tulip Design. Introduction to Astronomy Telescope Tutorial, noon to 2 p.m. Saturday at the Marion Blakemore Planetarium. People's Choice Cajun Cook-Off, 4:30 p.m. Saturday at the American Legion Hall. Live Rooftop Art Show, 6 p.m. Saturday at the Doubletree Hotel. Dueling Pianos, 7 p.m. Saturday at the Broke Horn. Brunch at the Gardens, 10 a.m. March 5th at Cafe at the Gardens. Market at the Gardens, 10 a.m. March 5th at the Cafe at the Gardens. Grand Opening Presote Midland, 11 a.m. March 5th, 4416 Briarwood. Cajun Carnival, noon March 5th at 1811 Tradewinds Boulevard. Grand Opening Cowboy Spirits, 1 p.m. March 5th at 4230 North Midland Drive. Vinyl Brunch, Dr. Seuss Edition, 10 a.m. March 6th at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Convention Center. Empty Bowls, 11 a.m. March 6th at the University of Texas, Permian Basin. Local eateries featured in show Exploring Lone Star State Spots by J.C. Lewis. The Texas Bucket List recently visited the Midland-Odessa area. The Texas Bucket List is a show dedicated to showing everything to see, do, and experience in the Lone Star State, according to its website. Midland's Fountainville Creamery and Soda Fountain shared their story about made-from-scratch West Texas flavors, including Black Gold. The Fountainville Creamery and Soda Fountain segment aired Saturday, but is not yet on YouTube. Curbside Bistro was featured for its sliders and fries. The restaurant, which started out as a food truck, is a winner of the James Beard Foundation Blended Burger Project. To view Curbside Bistro's segment, visit https://www.youtube.com/watch?VWDG C O I 4 X Y U. Raising Cane's largest Texas location planned for Odessa by J.C. Lewis. Raising Cane's is preparing to open its largest Texas restaurant at 4001 East 42nd in Odessa on March 29th, according to a press release. Midland's own Raising Cane's opened in February of 2020. The new restaurant is hiring more than 200 local crew members to help prepare quality chicken finger meals in the double kitchen and share it via a double drive-thru. Crew members for multiple positions ranging from crew to shift managers and beyond will be available. Odessa's first Raising Cane's opening will mark the second in the Permian Basin and 183rd location in Texas. We opened a Cane's in Midland 2 years ago, and it has been a huge success, creating tons of Caniacs in the area, said area leader of restaurants Doug Haley. So we couldn't be more excited to give Caniacs in Odessa a Raising Cane's to call their own. We're also thrilled to continue bringing hundreds of great jobs to the area. More local crew members means more hands on deck that are eager to proudly serve our community. Raising Cane's was one of only three restaurant brands named to Forbes' Best Employers for New Grads Top 100 list. The company's fast-paced fun culture and growth opportunities earned it a spot on Glassdoor's 100 Best Places to Work in the U.S. list in 2021. The company is hiring crew members now through March 28th at the meeting space inside Town Place Suites by Marriott Odessa, located at 4412 Tanglewood Lane. Candidates interested in positions at the new restaurant can apply by texting RCJOBS to 97211 or by visiting work@canes.com. Applicants will be contacted quickly to set up an interview after applying. Walk-ins are also welcome daily between 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, February 24th. Don Wayne Esslinger was born to Don Roy Esslinger and Wanda Leonard of Cameron, Texas, on April 6, 1939. He passed away at the age of 82, holding his daughter's hands on January 30th. Wayne leaves behind little brother Joe Esslinger. He is survived by his children, Christy Gottney, Dr. Elise Murray, Kendall Leon, Pastor Kurt Esslinger, and Tony Ace Esslinger. He also leaves behind several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Services will be held at St. Stephen Presbyterian Church in Fort Worth on Saturday, February 26th at 11 a.m. In lieu of flowers, please consider donating to Operation Texas Strong, a local nonprofit benefiting homeless veterans. Sherry Lloyd Parker passed away on February 12th. She is survived by her husband, Preston Parker of Midland, sons Russell Parker and wife Julie of Houston, Philip Parker and wife Robin of Lakeway, Texas, brother-in-law Truman Parker and wife Cheryl of Midland, one cousin John Marcel and wife Melissa of San Antonio, as well as five grandchildren, plus five nieces and five nephews. A celebration of life will be held on March 26th. Time and place is pending. Donald Marshall, age 80, of Midland, passed away February 21st. His family will receive guests from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday, February 24th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, February 25th, at Nally Pickle Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Isidro Marquez Flores, age 77, of Presidio, passed away Thursday, February 17th. Viewing will be Thursday, February 24th, from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., with a rosary at 7 p.m. Thursday evening at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Funeral Mass is set for Friday, February 25th at 10 a.m. at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Pat Stewart, age 74, of Midland, passed away February 19th. No service is planned. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Robert Lozano Paredes, age 74, of Odessa, passed away on Thursday, February 17th. Funeral service is set for Thursday, February 24th at 2 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home and Chapel. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements were made with Heavenly Gate Funeral Home and Chapel. Thomas O. Flournoy, age 97, of Midland, passed away on Sunday, February 20th. Thomas was born March 2nd, 1924. Fond memories and expressions of sympathy may be shared at www.ellisfunerals.com for the Flournoy family. Vance Oliver, age 81, of Midland, passed away on February 22nd. The family will receive guests from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Sunday, February 27th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, February 28th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Good morning. This is Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Thursday, February 24th, 2022. Campaign nastiness hits new levels. With only 2 days remaining to early vote and just 6 until Election Day, The nastiness of politics is on full display in Ector County. Unlike nationally, the political drama is not between Democrats and Republicans, but within the local GOP and the candidates vying for offices that will be decided on Tuesday's primary, as there are no Democratic challengers. The race of current State Representative Brooks Landgraf and the challenger Casey Gray has been testy from the start, but has reached a new level of nastiness, with Gray accusing Landgraf of having multiple affairs with men and women. A Lubbock woman, Tiffany Wilson, last week said she did not have an affair with Landgraf, but since that time has changed her story repeatedly, and the Odessa American cannot independently verify anything she has told the OA or social media outlets. Landgraf has declined to publicly address the allegations of an affair with Wilson or anyone else. When Gray dared Landgraf to publicly deny the affair during a recent forum, Landgraf said the truth will come out and he was not going to be baited by his opponent. Asked last week via email to provide proof of his claims, Gray simply asked if Landgraf had publicly denied the claims yet. Meanwhile, the Ector County GOP will meet tonight. Longtime Odessan Tommy Irvin on Wednesday was urging local Republicans to attend the meeting in support of Landgraf. Irvin said that in his opinion, Landgraf was the victim of a major smear campaign, and he'd like to show people their support for him by waving campaign signs outside the closed-door meeting. Ector County GOP Chairwoman Tisha Crow said precinct chairs had invited Landgraf to meet with them last week in the hopes of having some questions answered, but Landgraf did not show up. They've invited him to attend tonight's meeting, but he has not indicated one way or another if he will attend. They want to hear from him. They don't know what to do, and they won't know what to do until he answers their questions, Crow said. Asked what questions they have for Landgraf, Crow said she never asked, and they don't have to clear them with her. They've discussed many avenues they could take upon hearing from Landgraf, Crow said. Those opinions include doing nothing or asking him to resign, she said. Asked if they could decide to endorse Gray, Crow said that hasn't been discussed because up to this point, this has been about Brooks. Some members of the Ector County GOP Executive Board have sought before unsuccessfully to unseat Landgraf. Gray has also accused Landgraf of spreading misinformation about Gray's military service records and claims of stolen valor. However, claims of stolen valor and Gray actually came up during Gray's 2018 run for the congressional seat now held by August Pfluger. The OA has been contacted by more than a dozen people who have sent hundreds of pages of documents that question some aspects of Gray's military service and whether he has worked for the CIA, as he has said. Those people have also suggested Gray has exaggerated the nature of a helicopter incident in Korea and the injuries he sustained. Gray has said he has gone through more than 24 reconstructive surgeries and suffered a traumatic brain injury. He has given conflicting details about how much time he spent in the hospital recovering from his injuries. The OA has repeatedly asked Gray to respond to the allegations, inviting him to send his resume, any documentation he has regarding the helicopter crash, and standard form 50s, which is a form used by the federal government to document personnel actions such as hirings and terminations. I find it appalling that you continue these unethical attacks to attempt to discredit my military service. You are very much in the business of attacking military members and their service, and these absurd questions that seem to come from internet trolls and from Landgraf supporters are telling of your bias, Gary said via email. When asked via email to clarify how much time he spent in the hospital, Gray replied, I have had over 24 reconstructive surgeries and was assigned to a warrior transition battalion, which took over 5 years. I am still receiving surgeries to help me gain full function. On Tuesday, Gray provided a letter signed by a nurse case manager assigned to the now defunct community-based warrior in transition unit in McClellan, California, that lists some of the injuries Gray has said he sustained in the helicopter incident. According to the November 2012 letter, Gray was injured in a combat-related helicopter crash while deployed in support of Operation Enduring Freedom on March 25, 2011. Operation Enduring Freedom was launched following the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks and focused on removing the Taliban from power and crippling Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Attempts to reach the nurse case manager have proven unsuccessful. When asked for the crash report itself, Gray responded, "You seem to be more interested in perpetuating slander than actually interested in the truth." Gray was once quoted as saying that as a result of the brain injuries he sustained in the crash, he has no emotions or empathy, which make him very direct. Gray was asked if he thought that would impede his ability to get along with other lawmakers, or how he might compensate for something others might see as a liability. "Unfortunately, due to the medical condition stemming from my injury in service, I can come across not as I intend at times, and it is still something I must work on to improve. I am far from the polished politician and can come across as very direct and very non-politically correct. My hope is that if elected, I will get to know all my constituents personally and that they will know the real me," Gray wrote in part. As for questions about the CIA, Gray said he signed a non-disclosure agreement with the agency. He also said he didn't use a standard Form 50. "While I did work at the agency directly, some of the time, I also worked for them through my employment in the Navy. If you need further guidance, please refer your questions directly to the CIA at CIAGovernment. It seems you don't like going the official route and would rather make false accusations and skirt the truth by asking questions repeatedly until you get a response you want." Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths, who endorsed Landgraf and said he continues to support him, bemoaned the tone of the current campaign. "I'm saddened by how nasty this has gotten." Odessan Ronnie Lewis said some within the local GOP are determined to keep Landgraf from representing the district on accusations of an extramarital affair, but willfully ignore Gray has restraining orders against him and pending charges of bail jumping. Gray is accused of violating a restraining order twice and jumping bail on the two cases that were filed as a result of those alleged violations in Wisconsin. Online records also indicate Gray is involved in a child custody dispute in the same county. He has a court date in April on the bail jumping charges. Lewis said he is out of town, otherwise he would be at the Thursday meeting to support Landgraf. "It's time for the dirty campaigning out of the ECRP to stop."
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.